Case number 15-5070, Friends of Animals Appellant versus Sally Jewell in her official capacity as Secretary of Interior et al. Mr. Harris for the appellant, Mr. Oakley for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Harris and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Friends of Animals. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal. This is one of several cases that have been brought over the last decade involving three antelope species that are critically endangered in their home ranges in North Africa, but are being raised in the United States on ranches for the purpose of being hunted, primarily for sport. Each of these cases really presented a dispute between two parties, the hunting ranch industry and animal advocacy groups like Friends of Animals, as to whether these captive antelopes should be regulated under the Endangered Species Act. It had appeared that that question had been addressed and answered by Judge Kennedy in 2009 in an opinion that he wrote that became a final judgment stating that Section 10 of the Endangered Species Act applied to these captive antelope, that the ranches were under an obligation to obtain permits if they were intending to take them on these ranches, and that groups like Friends of Animals had a right to participate in the permitting process. Now, apparently unhappy with that outcome and with the outcome of some subsequent litigation that was brought to try to overturn it, hunting ranch industries found an ally in Congress, which leads to Section 127, a rider to the 2014 Consolidated Appropriations Act, which is a single sentence, doesn't change anything in the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act looks the same today as it did before 2014. What happened was that he directed Fish and Wildlife Service to essentially ignore the findings of Judge Kennedy that Section 10.
That's not what it said. The word ignore is not in there.
That's
right. It says, what did it say?
It said specifically to reinstate the 2005 rule without regards to any other provision of law, which without regards to any other provision of law means.
Doesn't Congress have the power to do that?
Congress has the power to change the law substantively, correct? But when you're looking at what Congress does that affects the judicial branch, I think that the lens is a little bit different. We have both the Plott case as well as Klein, and both of them are a little bit different. With Plott, I think you really have to say, what is the effect here? Was there really a prospective change in the law? What is it about the Endangered Species Act that is different today than it was before?
It's been overridden by an act of Congress in that particular.
I understand that's what the government will argue, but what it really did.
Well, isn't that a fact? It's been overridden in that particular by an act of Congress.
That's true, but whether that was constitutional or not is still a question that's pending. And when that decision by Congress to override, and you may say, what is it overriding? Is it overriding Judge Kennedy's interpretation, or is it overriding Section 10 altogether?
It doesn't say anything about Judge Kennedy's interpretation, does it?
I don't think it has to. I don't think in Plott that Judge Scalia was too worried about the intent specifically
of
Congress.
What was the judgment in Plott?
Well, the judgment in Plott was a decision that a claim under the Securities Exchange Act involving deceit and fraud was no longer valid, that the statute of limitations had run, and Congress attempted in a substantive statute to rewrite the statute of limitations so that the plaintiff could pursue its claims.
Abrams' case all involved judgments at law. This involves an administrative decision about the order of application of statute. Isn't that a very real difference?
I think that at the time the Constitution was written, we didn't engage in this type of judicial review of administrative agency lawmaking.
That's a good thing.
Maybe. But there are two different aspects of administrative law. One is, and I think a lot of the cases under Klein, and we could talk about these, really involve judicial review of a rulemaking decision. It's not really establishing the rights of anybody. But when it comes to the permitting process and the rules for permitting, it's adjudicative in nature. Listen, it really did involve rights. We brought this suit because we were excluded from the permitting process that we felt we had a right to in the adjudication.
The statute changed nothing about Judge Kennedy's opinion.
Well,
up through the time of the statute, the law remained as it was. There's no retrospective application. It simply says henceforth, the new statute will take precedence over any other law, which would include the ESA, henceforth.
Well, I think it's a fine line, but I think it's an important one for a couple reasons. One, I mean, the effect of it was, look, Judge Kennedy issued an interpretation of Section 10 regarding the rights of the Fish and Wildlife Service to issue blanket rules, the rights of Friends of Animals to participate, and obviously the obligations of the hunting ranches, who clearly feel aggrieved and were very, you know, felt that their rights were being impugned by Judge Kennedy's decision. And it overturned all of that without changing the substantive law.
The question of law as to whether the ESA overrode the...
I think that under Plow and all of the...
You still have the same standing you had before.
To participate? No, not with respect to the operative facts that were before Judge Kennedy regarding captive antelope. We don't have any rights anymore. They're gone. We can't comment on a single take of the captured antelope on these ranches. It's been completely...
Commenting is not standing.
I'm sorry.
As far as changing the law of standing, there's no change in the law that's applicable to your standing, is
it? Article 3 standing or standing?
Yes.
I don't think that would... No.
No change in that. And that's what Judge Kennedy was speaking
about. No, Judge Kennedy found we had standing. But no, he was speaking to our rights under Section 10 to participate. They went hand in hand there, of course. But the real claim there was...
Congress could enact everything in that rule without providing for any administrative proceeding, couldn't they?
Congress could change the Endangered Species Act. Going
forward... Let me take you back just a further step than that, though. Congress could abolish the whole administrative body involved here and directly enact the rules as law, could it not?
And Congress could actually probably alter Section 10 of the Endangered Species Act to exempt captive animals from requiring permits or even captive antelope. But that's all. Let's be frank, though.
An administrative body has only that power that is given. It has no constitutional authority. It has only that authority delegated to it by Congress, right?
Correct.
So if Congress doesn't delegate it anymore, then it can't do that anymore. And that's not a flaw. That's simply a fact.
Well, I'm not sure if it didn't... undelegated it. It just told it what to do. And in this particular...
Maybe it's prospective. It's not retroactive. The first opinion, Antelope 1, was not... The decision there was not changed. Congress can surely change statutory delegations, authority, administrative possibilities going forward. They do it all the time, and we're bound by that.
I think that's right, but I know it's a very...
And they can be inconsistent with what we previously decided.
I totally agree, but I know it's a very fine line. But I think what Justice Scalia was talking about in Plott is that you really need to look at what the effect is. Is this really the effect making a positive prospective change in the law? Or is it just issuing what he labels a corrective legislative judgment? And I think that if you think about it...
It has to be a corrective judgment with respect to the prior adjudicated case to change it.
It changed it. It didn't change the ESA. It changed only the interpretation of the ESA that Judge Kennedy delivered in his opinion.
Yeah, Congress said the ESA has... We are adding something to the ESA. It's different than it was yesterday, and we have a right to do that.
Well, I think that's reading more into it than when I said that it didn't do anything. Because, I mean, it really just tells...
Well, I know you want to say it didn't do anything.
But the problem is,
what did Congress do then? They did something.
The fact that you keep saying,
but it was only a sentence, or it was only a few words, why does that matter?
It matters tremendously.
I'm sorry.
As I said, I think that they could have amended Section 10 of the ESA. The difference, of course, is it's very easy to slip a one-line sentence into a budget bill that effectively dispels a judicial interpretation of an existing act
than it is to
substantively change the ESA.
Why is that different?
Why does it matter where it is? It's whether it's been done.
Well, but let's look at the reality of it. Endangered Species Act, outside of maybe Obamacare, is one of the most, you know, sort of threatened and attacked pieces of legislation.
Why should we be skeptical of riders, congressional riders? It's not our job.
I'm not saying, I take it back, maybe I didn't say that it's the rider mechanism itself. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that a substantive change to the ESA, even in a rider bill, would be very unlikely to become law. It hasn't. I mean, there's tons of attempts to
make that inquiry.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that that's an important distinction.
Powell seems so different in that it was a closed case,
right. Sure.
And the statute of limitations had run, yeah. And then Congress was going back into that closed case and extending the statute of limitations to reopen it. And sure. Justice Scalia's opinion is careful to characterize that as retroactive legislation altering sure. consequences that attach to your prior behavior.
You're correct, but if you go through his sort of complete analysis of how he got to that conclusion, looking at all of the evils of the legislature issuing corrective judgments and so forth, a lot of the cases that he cited weren't just reopening or telling the courts to go back to work on a particular case that they had closed, but really talked about literally private parties doing exactly what they did here, finding it easier to use the legislative branch to correct correct disagreements that it had with the court regarding its rights.
See, the problem you have is Wheeling is a closer case, and Plott cites Wheeling and says we don't mean to call it into question.
Well, but Wheeling, though, was never a final judgment. Wheeling was a case in equity in which an injunction was issued, which was subject to modification and would be today. And one of the grounds for modifying an injunction in a suit of equity includes a change in the legal status of whatever's at issue.
Right. It's a going forward. It's the same thing as here. It's looking forward.
But no,
Congress is effectively saying, as Wheeling says, going forward, here's what you can and cannot do. That's exactly what happened here.
The Supreme Court in Wheeling even said that if it was a case in law, it would have been different. And here, when Judge Kennedy issued a binding interpretation of Section 10 as to the rights of parties to participate or the obligations of parties to participate, it was a determination of law. It interpreted a statute. There's no equity at issue. He wasn't going to say, oh, by the way, things have changed on the ground. Now we think it should be more fair for us not to get a permit. Or it was just a binding interpretation.
That doesn't mean anything about what Judge Edwards is saying. This is a going forward mandate by Congress, not a retroactive correction, as you would say, for something that happened before.
Well, I understand that that's the government's view. I'm just distinguishing Wheeling, though.
Why isn't that a fact?
Isn't it right?
As opposed to simply the government's view.
Because all of what Judge Kennedy said with respect to how the statute applies with respect to anything other than U.S. captive herds is still in play. And there's nothing going forward. There's nothing that's been, Congress didn't change that.
But it's changed our adjudicated rights to participate in that
one
process.
Piece because Congress changed the statute. Mm-hmm.
But I understand. Can I maybe move to Swift then for a second, which is obviously a different argument? And that has to do with our ongoing litigation over the validity of the permits. And in that case, Klein is different. Now, in Klein, the Supreme Court in Robinson said that there actually has to be a detectable change in the law. And actually, going back to Plow, when Justice Scalia was looking at that, he said it needs to be a change in the substantive criteria that a court would apply. There's been no change in the substantive criteria under the Endangered Species Act. It remains the same as it was today, as it was then, and the only thing that was changed was the rights that were adjudicated by Judge Kennedy, and it also changes our ability to continue to participate, whether it's in the administrative process or pursue judicial review of the permits that are being issued. I think I saw a question of standing. I'm not sure if it's come up, and I know actually Judge Sintel, you said that jurisdiction is the thing that should be argued first. I think that the only thing I'd say there is I feel there was a disconnect in the district court between what our injury was and what our claims were. I think understanding it's important to note that as long as the action that the government took injures you, you should have, and that the court could redress that injury, that you would have standing to bring the case. And they look at the Field case, which is a completely different situation in which it was a Section 9 claim that was brought, and they were alleging informational injury under Section 10, and the court just found that it was too speculative. And somehow the court below read that as saying that you sort of have to raise your claims.
I'm inclined to think you have standing, but I want to make sure you state it. What is the harm here that you say is caused by the respondent?
Well, every court that's looked at Section 10C, including...
Don't tell me what every court's done.
Sure.
Tell me what is the harm here. Let's just wait.
Section...
What is the harm here that you say is caused by the respondent?
Sure.
It can be remedied in this case.
Right. So prior to Section 127 being enacted, we had a right under Section 10C not only to obtain the application materials that were submitted to Fish and Wildlife Service, but to have all the information before the agency at every stage of the proceeding so we could participate.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Robert Oakley. I'm here on behalf of the federal defendants and the appellees. I think I should start off with standing. I'd like to correct at the beginning a basic error in the reply brief of Friends of Animals where they say, don't look at this case under Lujan, under the standards for injury for Lujan, look at it under Aikens. There's no difference. Aikens cites Lujan five times. And so the standard, whether the injury is informational or it's a different type of injury, has to meet the criteria for Lujan.
They were entitled to information. The statute took away, in their view, that entitlement to information. They're deprived of the information that they otherwise want. They say that's unconstitutional. Under Aikens, why isn't that good enough? They want to use the information for a variety of purposes.
It's not good enough because the injury is not specific enough. In Aikens, the court clearly recognized it was granting standing on an informational basis to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It still went through
a public citizen and Havens as well on that front.
Yes, but an interesting thing, especially if you look at Havens, you need to look at the type of the information and what was the effect of the denial. Havens was involved a housing organization that was trying to find housing for poor people in the Chicago area. So if they got false information from realtors that there were no apartments available in the north side part of Chicago called Rogers Park, they'd pass that misinformation on to them. It was practical information that they were in the business of.
Well, you're fine on Havens. What about Aikens?
Aikens, again, it found a specific enough need, and I think I would direct this court's attention to what Friends of Animals are complaining about here. And they're complaining here, really, that the government, under Section 10C, allows sport hunting of these endangered species.
I don't understand Aikens say a whole lot about setting the level of need required to have information.
But there has to be...
You understand? You're not surprised where I think Aikens was wrongly decided. But it was decided.
It was decided, and this court has to follow it. But I think there is a distinction here. If you look at pages, I think 94 in particular, where they lay out their harms, they are all harms about affecting their ability to advocate for the end of sport hunting of these endangered species.
Seems to establish a right to standing on a pure informational basis. If a statute provides a right to the information, I don't understand the plaintiffs in Aikens to have needed to show what they were going to do with the information.
There was discussion.
I once did, but I don't anymore.
I would agree with Your Honor, but as to different statutes, I think it's clear as to FOIA. For example, all you have to do is show you ask for some information. And
we're not asking you to concede the validity of your claim here, just that it states enough to get an overstanding. And then you can move on.
We have debated this quite a bit because we're familiar with this court's decisions. And we know that there's quite a bit of discussion going on in various cases about associational standing based on alleged denial of information. And I think I would respectfully say, Judge Sintel, that I think Aikens actually pulls back from cases like Supreme Court cases like Public Citizen because
cites Public Citizen approvingly in the key paragraph on 21.
It does. But in Public Citizen, the requirements for FOIA are just you ask and you don't get what you... You could ask for anything. You could ask for pictures of Elvis.
What they're saying here before, and I may be oversimplifying or misunderstanding, we had the right to comment before. And now we don't have the right to comment. So it's not exactly information, but it's a First Amendment situation analogous to the...
Can I ask you respectfully, why are you wasting time on this when you see the case law is what it is, and why don't you get to the merits?
I want to get to the merits very much.
You want to take all your time. I'm not getting it.
And I think I'm going to move there pretty quickly.
Like now?
Now.
You're really good.
I think, but I just...
Now, Counselor.
Okay, now I will, but just I'm not conceding. I'm just moving.
I understand.
All right. So let's go then to why this case is not like Plout or why it's not like Plout. This is an APA case. So the only thing that happened when Judge Kennedy found the rule invalid was that the case was remanded back to the agency to come up with a valid rule. He didn't tell the agency how to write that rule. The agency even considered if it would be possible, it would obviously be very difficult, but would it be possible on a different administrative record to justify the original rule, and concluded it could not. But it considered it. And it would have not automatically have been wrong. It would have been risky, but it would not have automatically been wrong for the agency to do that. The agency could have created a different standard for these three species in terms of reporting. There's a host of things to be done. So it was not a final fixed process. It's not like Plout, where, because of the Supreme Court's decision on the statute of limitations, the cases were finally dismissed, they were done, there was no way to revive them. They're just not analogous at all. And Judge Scalia was, I think, quite open about this, that this would work if the change were prospective. I mean, this is a quote from his decision. Congress can always revise the judgments of Article III courts in one sense. When a new law makes clear it is retroactive, an appellate court must apply that law in reviewing judgments still on appeal that were rendered before the law was acted and must alter the outcome accordingly. So possibly if the next day Congress had changed the law, maybe this, the cases were still in, or better yet, before the argument. But what Congress can't do, and what Congress did not do here, is go back and say, well, no, Supreme Court, you're wrong. The law when you decided the Lamp case, which is the case that changed, that resolved the circuit split of the statute of limitations, that decision was wrong, and so it has no effect. Congress cannot do that. Congress did not do that. The cases that counsel referred to that are pending but stayed in district court, which were based on the period of time when rule was in place where the permits were being, notice of the permits were being published in the Federal Register, those cases are not necessarily affected by this rider. They're pending, but they've disputed that whether the permits require compliance or the permits did comply with 10C. And those cases, we're not asking this court to address them in any way. But from now on, the Congress has changed the rule. And as far as language, there's no magic language. Although at times I think Friends of Animals is looking for some magic language, which we don't know about, because they say, well, it didn't do enough. This language is notwithstanding any other provision of law. It's very similar to the language in the National Coalition to Save Our Mall case from this court, where Congress said, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the plans for monuments on the mall were going to satisfy these various environmental statutes like NEPA and other statutes. And that was satisfactory. Really, if you look at Plout, that's their only case. There's a lot of speculation from language from cases, but they don't have any other case where Congress has said, well, except for Klein, which I'll get to in a second, this invades this lack of language. Not enough was said, they have no cases on that, means that nothing happened, that Congress passed a bill with a provision in it, but nothing happened. They just don't have that case. Klein is a very unique case. It involved the question of the president's pardon power, which and constitutional implications there. But the bottom line here is that Congress was not acting to come into an ongoing case and say, this is what you have to do in this one case. I have to say there's a lot of confusion about what Klein does mean. But if you look at the Robinson case from the from the Supreme Court, where Congress passed a statute which said if certain measures were done or satisfied with in ongoing cases, and it named the cases by docket number, then the government, and it had to do with management of national forests, would be in compliance with law. And that was upheld by the Supreme Court over a Klein challenge. So there's simply no case where Klein has yet to be, has been used since Klein to overturn a statute. And if we look at it, the only thing that happened here is the judge said, Judge Kennedy said, my opinion is the exemption allowed from the reporting requirements from 10C is contrary to the statute. Congress changed the statute. He didn't say anything about cases that were litigated before then. It wasn't critical of Judge Kennedy. He's not mentioned. And from now on, the statute isn't inconsistent with that rule because Congress told the government to reinstate that rule. So unless the court has other questions on these issues, I would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
So I want to come back to Klein and Robinson for just one moment. And although the words that have been mentioned here, you know, without, you know, any concern of any other laws has been used in other writers, none of the cases in the post-Robinson era relied solely on that itself being the change in the law. If you look at Robinson itself, it clearly changed. And again, Robinson says that Congress must change the substantive law in some detectable way. And in Robinson, Congress did just that. Because the agency in that case was having trouble complying with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, it stated, it was in a rider, but it was substantive. It said, in an alternative to complying with the existing requirements of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the agency can also comply in this particular matter. So it changed the substantive law. If you look at the other cases that followed, Stop H3 Association, Mount Graham, and Consuelo, all of those cases involved substantive changes in the law. Congress had previously granted broad delegation rulemaking authority. The agency was having problems complying with its mandates on certain projects, and Congress said, look, instead of doing what you're doing, this is what you're going to do. You're going to build a highway from this mile marker to this mile marker, or you're going to put a telescope here on in the Mount Graham case. Very substantive changes in the law that was directing those delegations. You come to two cases that are more problematic, Save Our Mall and Wild Rockies. Quite frankly, they seem to be inconsistent with Robinson. There was no detectable change in the substantive law in either. And the court grappled with what to do with the language about, you know, just do it, don't worry about what else the law says and so forth, and never hinged itself on that being actually a detectable change in the law. Both those cases ultimately said, well, they also said that it shouldn't be subject to judicial review, and that's a detectable change in the law. Nothing like that happened here. There is no detectable change in the substantive law. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted.